Item 7, review total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30th, 2018. Ed, welcome.
See, everyone has the book in front of them. Great.
Yep.
Taking a look at tab one. First, take a look at the economic environment. And like the economic environment, this is going to be a little bit disjointed, a little bit all over the place. Feel free to ask questions as they come to you, because there are a lot of good topics to discuss. It just doesn't have a good flow because there are such a variety of topics. So we might spend a little bit more time on this than normal, given the volatility of the markets and what all has been happening. But if we turn to page 4 to start with, we have what drove the market in Q2. We have a couple key themes going on here. First, on the upper left-hand side, we have the tariffs. And this is the total proposed goods subject to U.S. tariffs and table. And then right beside that on the right-hand side, you can see this chart showing the proposed versus implemented. And so this obviously has a time delay component to it, which is why there's more proposed than actually implemented. But it also highlights this trend that we're seeing in the tariffs in terms of there's talk of what the tariffs may be, creating a negotiating point with our trading partners, so that which in some cases have led to substantive changes reducing the actual proposed tariffs or the actual implemented. So that's an important dynamic here. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. Down below on the left-hand side, we have GDP consensus expectation. You can see some pretty nice numbers there, threes across March, April, May, June. So this was the Q2 GDP expectation. And the first read of that number, which came out after the printing of this book, was a 4.1% GDP for the U.S. So a nice surprise there.
I read that on Twitter, by the way, that 4.1. There was someone who was touting it pretty heavily.
Oh.
Yeah, it was huge.
Just going by recollection.
It went viral.
Down below that, we have a federal employee, by the way.
Yeah, never happened before. That's what I understand. It's just, it was the first time ever.
History might teach us something different about that, but yeah. It was huge. Down below that, we have the rising dollar sparks tumult in emerging markets. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. The dollar effect for us investors investing in international markets has had a pretty significant effect this quarter. And then at the bottom left, we have the flattening yield curve. This is the 10 minus 2-year yield spread. And we show that going to 33 basis points in June. So the flattening of the yield curve today, it's about 23 basis points. So it's even further flattening. And that's often an indicator, but we'll talk about what that actually indicates in a moment. So let's first start by turning to page 8 and talking a little bit more about these tariffs. And so we have some important text, which I encourage you all to read. Again, there's the recap of the proposed versus implemented, and then the average tariff rate, which we showed a different chart last quarter, highlighting just how significant these are. United States at 1.6, China at 3.5, lined up against several other countries. But we've seen some impacts now of this, because as the tariff discussions have gone on, it's caused some market reaction. And so part of the reaction is, one is the impact on currencies in terms of expecting what the U.S. is doing here and what it's going to impact abroad is having an impact on where the currencies themselves are trading. It's also had a pretty significant impact on emerging markets. And so when we think about our trade relationship with China and China being a major emerging market and that tariffs generally aren't a good thing for trade, that's had a negative impact on Chinese equities. Similarly, there's a trickle-down effect because a lot of other emerging market countries feed into what China is producing, and so it's had a trickle-down effect on them, and so a big impact in that respect. Trade balance, we've watched our trade balance actually tick up, meaning that we are net exporting more, importing less, where there's an expectation that if these trade tariffs are going to go into effect, let's buy the goods now before the tariffs go into effect. And so we actually exported more, which helped raise our GDP calculation. So when we say that we expected 3.4 and the first print is 4.1, that surprise is partially due to that trade effect. And so this tariff story is really unfolding in a number of different ways. So we'll continue to keep an eye on it. There's no clear result here. One thing that we are seeing as well is that the response by the various countries is across the spectrum. On the one hand, we have conversations with Europe, and they're saying, okay, let's reach a deal. Let's figure out something. And in fact, President Trump is saying, here's a starting proposition. Let's have no tariffs. Let's eliminate all of them and encourage free trade. How do you feel about that? And we've watched our trade partners say, whoa, 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 we're not ready for that. So in the midst of us saying, let's raise tariffs, he's also saying, we're raising tariffs to prove a point, that tariffs aren't good. And if you want to then create good open trade, let's reduce them to zero. And then it kind of calls the bluff of the trade partner to say, okay, there is something here, and they aren't willing to do that. But when Juncker came to visit Trump and they negotiated a better deal there, that is indicative of how it's being used as a negotiating tactic. Similarly, we keep expecting results on NAFTA with Mexico and Canada, potentially together, potentially separate, we don't know. But that can be a trade response as well. Whereas the trade response from China has been tit for tat, where every time we suggest that we're going to raise tariffs, they correspondingly raise tariffs in some other way. And so that is really interesting, because then what we're seeing in Europe, the European response is very different from the Chinese response. And so how that plays out then could be a different kind of policy response, and which is kind of what we were talking about last quarter. We were talking here about, you know, when you get into tariffs discussion, controlling the other side of that becomes really difficult. And so even if we were to retract ours, it's not necessary that they would retract theirs. And so this is kind of a difficult game to play. But so interesting times, obviously having some important impact.
Ed, to just comment on somehow there's a, what, 4-to-1 differential between what we sell to China and what China sells to us. And the impact, those differentials would appear to be very much in our favor.
That's right.
And the last few days, maybe the last week, the sense has been that there is some Chinese hints that they are ready to talk about at least the thing that seems to be the most aggravating, the stealing of intellectual property, mm-hmm. By the Chinese, blatant stealing of it. And doing something about that. Any reaction back on those comments?
Just that all your points are spot on. So the intellectual property being kind of the hidden war underneath the tariffs is really important to us. And so we need to, and important to the rest of the world. And so as we look at China becoming a larger economy, getting away with that kind of behavior isn't something we're willing to tolerate, nor is the rest of the world. So taking a stance and using tariffs as a tool to bring that to the table is a really key potential victory. We'll see how it plays out. So spot on with that. The 4-to-1 number is exactly consistent with our analysis that we tend to import about 500 billion. We tend to export about 100 billion. And that of the four is creating that dynamic. And so it is a much bigger impact to them. And so we think that that's an effective tool to get them to the table. I promise this would be a little bit disjointed. So if we turn to page 11, we can talk a little bit about the labor market. So this continues to tighten, which is great. We always look at this as a potential sign for inflation. And so the labor market here, we're showing that the U3, the headline unemployment rate, is down to 4% at the end of June. Since then, it's down a tick lower to 3.9% in August. The U6 unemployment rate is also ticking down, so 8% down to 7.8%. So both of those numbers continue in that direction. And page 12 then raises the question, well, if that's the case, is the labor market getting tight? And the broad speculation that we see in the news is that, yes, it is getting tight, that employers will have to pay more, that's going to cause wages to go up, and that can be a source of inflation. Well, we point out that there's a participation rate gap here, and no one knows what that participation rate should be. It's just kind of a question of where it is. But if you compare it historically, you can see that there is still a large percentage of people who have not rejoined the labor force. So if we take it back to 1998, you can see that the participation rate was north of 64, a little bit shy of 65%. And today we're a little bit north of 60%. So there's still a delta in there that we're kind of raising the question, well, if those people want to rejoin the workforce, that could continue to keep wages low or moderate in terms of growth rates, and thus we don't see it as an inflation cause just yet. Now, we could be wrong about that because, again, we don't know what the participation rate should be in today's environment. We just can tell you what it is, but it looks like there's some slack in that statistic.
So is this, and do these folks include the many people who were affected in the downturn in the 08, 09, 10 time frame, who simply, after years of looking, just gave up, threw in the towel? So they're able to work, stopped looking, got despondent, did something else, either retired, you know, learned to live with less or whatever. Are all those people in that group?
Exactly. That's exactly right. Yep.
Isn't it safe to assume that a less than stellar skill set is also a big factor in that?
Yeah.
The spots that are open, these individuals are not qualified for.
That's right. And so coming out in 2010, 11, 12, we saw a story unfolding about people going back and getting retrained, a tick up in student loans and such. So assuming that they've gone through that process, the people who have chosen not to have either said, yeah, I'm going into early retirement, I don't have the wherewithal or interest to do the retraining,
yeah.
I'm effectively staying out of the labor force.
Right.
Yeah. And the real punchline to this then is, so what's the Fed think? Is the Fed looking at this and saying, tight labor market, cause for inflation, therefore we should raise rates sooner or more? Or are they looking at it and saying, okay, we still see some slack as well. We think that current rate policy makes sense. We're going to stay on that track. And so what we're seeing in the markets then is the Fed saying two more rate raises in calendar year 2018. And the market pricing in one in September, but a 50-50 probability on one in December. So that's kind of how the market is interpreting this today. The next page, page 13, is about the consumer. This is something we normally don't touch on a lot, but there was an important revision. And so in the text, in fact, the last paragraph here, we note in the second sentence that the personal savings rate was only 3.2%. And that's been ticking down, and you can see the chart in the lower right-hand corner of how much it has been ticking down and saying personal savings has kind of run its story. People looking to spend more have to take out loans, credit card debt, what have you, to spend more. So consumer spending is a huge source of future economic growth here in the U.S. How does it all play out? So I'm highlighting this because there was a revision from the source of personal savings rate. I'm not sure if that's Bureau of Labor Statistics or who it is, but that number was revised. In fact, a trailing history of that number has been revised. So the actual rate for May was 6.8%, and the June number is also 6.8%, and the trailing history shows a very different chart here than what we're showing in the personal savings rate. Basically, within the past year and a half to 2 years, that number doesn't tick down nearly as much. In fact, it ticks up. So you can imagine where 6.8 would plot on the furthest right-hand side. And so that's given a lot of comfort that, oh, actually, people have been saving. They haven't been loading up on debt. The balance sheet is good. Household net worth is good. And when you take into consideration the appreciation of the equity markets, fixed income generally staying moderately flat, and value of real estate increasing, the consumer is actually in pretty good shape. And so when we think forward about future economic growth here in the U.S., that gives us some reassurances that we're not looking at a recessionary cause, we're actually looking at a strength. Interesting step revision. We don't normally see revisions that large and that substantive.
Ed? How much do you think that the mild wage growth is playing into some of these numbers as well, the savings rates?
So far, not so much.
Okay.
So we're seeing it tick up, but it kind of has the tick up, tick down behavior. We haven't seen a strong trend develop to say things have changed, things are different yet. So we keep looking for it because anecdotally, it sounds like it should.
Uh-huh.
We're just not seeing it through the numbers yet.
Okay.
So, you know, there's probably a lag effect there. So I would expect it to start to show itself, but we're not seeing it yet. Page 18 allows us to turn to the international side of things. And the international economy, we can take a look at the numbers and see how they compare. And not a whole lot of change. We're seeing the U.S. growing more so than Eurozone. Japan continues to register positive growth, which is the victory there. The BRICS countries, driven by India and China, showing positive growth there. So we continue to believe that the emerging markets story is a positive one. The difference here, though, is in the last bullet point, the text, the U.S. dollar appreciated 5% during the quarter. Going to talk a little bit about that because that change is pretty significant. As you look at the various economies around the world and say, so what's going on? What is causing that? Why is the dollar appreciating? It's because of the relative differences. And so for the past several quarters, we've been talking about synchronized global growth, a synchronized global recovery. And now we're starting to see that take place at different speeds. And so the U.S. starting to accelerate a little bit faster, Europe tending to stay about where they are, and some of the emerging market countries slowing down. And so that storyline is starting to transpire. And you can see that on page 18, where we have the GDP growth expectations outlined here. So on the left-hand side of 18, on the bottom, you can see where the U.S. is lining up, 18 and 19, so coming in pretty close to 3%. Germany, Eurozone, UK at 2 or below 2%. Emerging markets continuing to be a positive 5%. So that's starting to show part of that reason.
Is it fair to say, though, that the emerging markets growth is actually lagging behind expectation currently?
No, I wouldn't say that so much except for a couple countries. So I think we have Brazil, Argentina, and Turkey are kind of dominating the news in emerging markets. I think China is potentially slowing down and tariffs aren't helping it. So that could be. But in general, we're seeing that as still the growth engine of the global economy. So I don't think that story has changed. So maybe on a relative basis, it's roughly in parity. And so maybe the absolute numbers have ticked down a little bit.
Thank you.
And I wanted to tie that in then to
one thing on page 19. It seems to me that the headline there is more a matter of Italy talking about leaving the EU as opposed to political shakeup in Italy. Sort of like what's new about political shakeup in Italy? About every month and a half.
A new leader every year on average is
his
that's not
status quo.
Yeah.
That's right, that's not a shakeup.
That's a good point. Good, good, good. I wanted to touch on page 23 a little bit about the yield curves. The inversion of the yield curve. This chart is kind of interesting. Takes a little bit of time to digest exactly what we're showing here. But what we're showing is the 10 minus 2 yield curve. So this indicates steepness or flatness. As you take a look at the furthest to the right point of that jagged blue line, you can see it approaching zero, which is to indicate a flat yield curve between the 10-year and 2-year yields in U.S. Treasuries. What the orange and the blue show then, the blue is showing the time before a technical recession, a recession being defined as 2 sequential quarters of GDP registering a negative growth number. And then the orange is showing time before equity market peak. And so even once the yield curve goes inverted, does that mean the equity markets sell off? And so here we're showing that the technical time before a recession has been 2.5, 1, 1.5, 3, 2 years. So typically a kind of a 2-year time frame. And then the time before the equity market peaks is also around 2 years. So the fact that the yield curve goes inverted isn't in and of itself the time to say, let's get out of U.S. equities. In fact, earnings have generally continued to do well, as we showed last quarter. And so it's an early indicator, but not necessarily a requirement. So it's maybe in math terms, you might think that it's necessary, but not sufficient.
Ed, the Fed controls the short end. So they make the decision when they increase the short end to go to an inverted level, I would think, in the short term. Obviously, long term, the long end is what it is by market forces. But in the short term, it's only going to happen because we elect to make it happen.
Yes and no. So there's that's a good point. The Fed is mainly involved in the U.S. 30-day. And so the 30-day treasury, the Fed funds rate, where they target that, then where they maintain it in terms of their 1.75 target today is that. When we look at that spread between the 30 and the 10, it's still not steep, but it's not flat. And so another way of looking at this is to take exactly what you're saying and say, fine, show me the chart of the 30-day versus 10-year and tell me when that goes inverted. That's more interesting to me. And I think there's a lot of merit to that argument. And when we take a look at that, it's not suggesting inversion. It still has some steepness to it, so it's not even flat at this point. So I agree with you. And therefore, that doesn't give us concern about a recession on the horizon. The other component to it is, while a yield curve, either one, may go flat or inverted, tell me when real rates rise. Because real rates are the difference between the nominal yield and the inflation. Tell me when those real rates rise, because that's what actually impacts a corporation's cost of borrowing. When real rates are rising, then it becomes more expensive to them because they can't pass along through prices to their consumers, their customers. So the rise in real rates isn't shown here either. So it's kind of the mixed bag. Show me when yield curve flattens or inverts. Show me when real rates rise. When you put those two together, now I have a pretty good indication that we're going to expect a recession. So we're not seeing it yet. Definitely a flattening event going on, but continuing to recommend that we maintain equity market exposure, and even when inversion happens, you still have some time before we actually see a recession historically.
Any sense of the Fed responding to the president's admonition the other day that they're letting rates go up too fast?
I hope not. You know, I hope that the Fed maintains its independence as best it can, and that would be a much better response. So,
in some ways, it forces them to maintain their independence by doing some of those things as well.
Yeah. I'll tell you, our Fed today does a much better job of broadcasting what its views are and really laying that out to the market than the Greenspan era and his predecessors. So it's really changed a lot under the Bernanke approach and now Yellen. And so, yeah, much more transparent.
Did they always used to release? I didn't remember the release of the minutes and all that from decades past. That it seems more transparent now, you know, clearly.
That's a good question. I don't know when that came into effect. I don't know if that's always been the case or not. It strikes me as probably it has been, but I don't know.
Yeah, it just might not have gotten the attention. And in the 24/7 news cycle now, it gets, you know, gets an immediate distribution. So
yeah, that and the beige book, which apparently isn't beige. Speculations on how thick Greenspan's attaché was as to indicating whether it was going to be a rate rise or not.
That's good.
So okay. We've gotten a little bit better on those fronts. I'd like to turn to page 29 for a quick view on the equity markets. A couple key points here. 29 on the quarter, year-to-date, and 1 year shows this hedged versus unhedged basis. So you can compare the returns that we have, first beginning U.S. large caps at 3.6 and small cap at 7.8, give you a reference point as you look down. Because international large cap developed markets, so the EFA index, showing a 3.9% on a hedged basis, but the currency just completely wiped that out, and U.S. investors, if they were unhedged, got a negative 1.2%. Similarly, U.K., look how significant that is on a hedged basis, almost a 10% return. U.S. investors, negative 3.1%. And emerging markets, currency effect here, negative 3.6, so they did lose a bit in the quarter, but then the currency took it down even more. And then a couple points here also about value versus growth. As you see, the U.S. large cap value, a positive 1%, and versus growth at a positive 5.8, a pretty big difference. And you take a look at the 1 year column, much greater, 6% return versus 22.5. And so a couple key points there about that. That might in and of itself lead you to believe we should probably rebalance. We should probably take some out of the growth side, invest it in value. This return disparity is kind of something we want to look at and think that we can capture. For better or worse, though, that's actually been supported by earnings. And so the earnings numbers have been increasing by that much on the growth side, and they've been increasing by that little on the value side, such that the value growth disparity actually isn't there. The valuations are suggesting they're actually consistent with historical trend. So the difference is really understanding what's in the growth bucket and what's in the value bucket. And when you take a look at the growth companies, you think about a lot of the tech names. And the tech names have been hitting the ball out of the park on earnings consistently here. On the value side, you have a lot of financials, and the banks haven't been hitting it out of the park as compared to the growth side of the equation. And so we think that that value growth style tilt is actually in par right now. So we're not recommending a rebalancing along those lines.
Yes, sir. Are the earnings being supported artificially by stock buybacks?
No. We're seeing the top line revenue growth also growing and surprising analysts on the upside. So the strength really looks like it's there.
Following up on Harvey, is that artificial? Are stock buybacks, unless they are disguising stock compensation, is it artificial?
I wouldn't think so, because I think when you're talking about stock buybacks, and if you're talking about like the process of a company issuing debt, taking on more on its balance sheet, and then buying back stock and saying, well, that's just financial engineering, you're not doing anything different here. That company can only do that for so long before it has a leveraged balance sheet and before the equity markets are saying, you've gone too far and we're going to penalize you for that. So unless they're doing that. So, you know, I think there's some merit to, you know, a CFO.
You use Apple as an example here with $200 billion in cash or whatever the number is. Presumably they don't have to go out and issue debt to buy back stock.
Right.
So I'd describe that as technically permanent, you know, until the next buyback or issuance. But,
yep.
Yeah, okay.
And then the stock buyback is really a decision between whether doing the stock buyback or issuing the dividend with that cash, if they're doing it with the cash on the balance sheet. And that's just a choice that the CFO is making in terms of what's most tax efficient or what they want to accomplish there. But net, they're roughly equal. I think as investors, we'd probably prefer dividends, but yeah. All right, let's jump ahead to page 31, take a look at the domestic equities a little bit more. So here we're showing the price appreciation on the left-hand side of the Russell 3000, which captures large cap and small cap. Calendar year earnings growth, so this is the total year, and you can see how 2017 was a pretty good year at 12%, but nothing compared to 2018 at 20.6%, and 2019 estimated at 9.9%. We'll see if that number gets revised up, because Q2 numbers are largely in, and the year-over-year growth rate for Q2 has been a little bit shy of 25%. Holy cow, 25% year-over-year earnings growth, sales 10%, 9.9. So pretty significant there. And what did change over the last couple of quarters is where that revenue is coming from. And so those companies with more than 50% exposure to rest of world, thinking about like, you know, is McDonald's is a U.S. company but makes most of its money around the rest of the world, its sales have increased by about 8.6%. Not McDonald's specifically, companies that get more than 50%. Companies that get less than 50% of their earnings from the rest of the world increased by 13.5%. So the more domestically focused companies have done better in the past quarter than those that are more internationally focused. And that has changed. That's a different line on the trend. So again, tariffs at play. And if we take a look at 33, we can take a look at the international markets. This is developed equities first. And so here we have the effect of currency, so the currency piece in the lower left-hand corner causing us some decline. Earnings growth in the middle, you can see here that the U.S. is now ticking up above the others. And so here we are showing emerging markets rolling over a little bit. So Trustee Gordon, to your question earlier, I think this chart supports your question that it is rolling over a little bit there. And then on the right-hand side, the forward PE, so the price to earnings multiples, you're seeing that the U.S., while ticking down because the valuations and the earnings are supporting these prices, is still the highest of the three between EFA and emerging markets. So U.S. still looks relatively expensive, even though it's gotten cheaper, which reinforces our view that emerging markets are a good place to invest. And page 34 helps support that a little bit, showing the equity performance, the growth premium, and the earnings growth. So this combination that the earnings are still there, the GDP growth is still there, the currency dynamic has worked against us. If it were to recover, emerging markets could be a great time to invest there. We'll take a look in the performance of the plan, how we suffered in this quarter with our exposure to emerging markets, and this helps explain some of the macro underpinnings for that.
And just on the emerging markets, there's been some talk of the emerging market dollar-denominated debt having a knock-on effect to local economies and then to some of these companies here. How concerning is that to Verus at this point? I understand we're not in the emerging market debt, we're in the emerging market equity, but that flow through there.
Yeah, the performance between emerging market debt issued in hard in local terms was pretty huge in first and second quarter. So these are the countries that are issuing in their own currency, whereas hard currency means that the country can't issue debt in what's a good example? Some real or Brazil can't issue in whatever the Brazilian currency is. So what they do is they issue it in dollar terms, or yen terms, or pound, or euro, or something like that. They'll issue in one of the hard currencies. So the countries that issue in local currencies, much smaller universe, so that's only 15 countries that can really effectively do that in terms of the index. That smaller universe had a lot of trouble, so they are suffering the currency impact to a much greater extent. We don't see that as being a concern and a knock-on effect, because what we're seeing in countries like Argentina or Turkey, where they are suffering a real crisis, that's an issue because they have domestic policies at play, they have potential corruption or leadership at play, they have upside-down balance sheets, they need IMF support, things like that. They're reliant on external funding in a big way, and there's a concern that that external funding will go away because of all of these concerns, and if it does, it causes a real crisis. So we're seeing that in terms of those specific countries. We don't see it as a contagion kind of effect, is I think where you're going with that. Yeah. So we see it isolated, not a contagion at this point.
Is Greece having to do with it, what they're doing? Turkey.
Turkey.
Lira and a dot. No,
yeah, the lira is, you could possibly call it a collapse at this point. I think in this book we have it somewhere showing that it was down 18% as of June. It's down about 60% versus the U.S. dollar year to date as of yesterday. So, collapsed.
Ed, while you're talking about currencies, I've been hearing some concern lately about like the future dollar being devalued because of some of the things that are going on. Can you comment on that?
Do you have more in terms of?
I just read something the other day about it, and I was like, that's interesting, because, I mean, the dollar's been pretty strong for a while now.
Say, like, what things were going on?
I
remember, yeah.
How would you devalue the dollar?
Well, we can do it a couple ways.
I'm talking as a government decision to devalue. How do you do that?
Yeah, so one way to do it is to lower interest rates. And so what we're doing today is we are sporting some of the higher interest rates around the world because of where our 10-year is and where our short term is versus negative yields on the short term in Germany and very slightly positive yields on the longer end of the curve in Germany. So a German investor could say, well, let me borrow at those rates. I'm happy to borrow at low rates, and I'll invest it in U.S. dollar, and I'll collect the premium. That's called a carry trade. And I'm willing to take the bet on whether the currency, the foreign exchange rate compensates me for that or not. I'm betting it doesn't. And so I'm happy to just let that money sit in the U.S. and earn the yield there. So then what we could do is just lower rates, and it would do that. Quantitative easing here and around the world was a way of doing that, saying we're purposefully weakening our balance sheet. And for a time, we watched country after country do that to both take on low rates and do quantitative easing type exercises to devalue their currency, to make it less attractive, and that then allows them to do exactly that.
Venezuela just cut five zeros off its currency. we don't have any option like that.
not as the reserve currency around the world. That would not be too favorable.
Million percent devaluation or something, or inflation?
95 or 6 or something. I mean, it was high 90s.
Yeah. Making the Deutschmarks and look pretty good from
Zimbabwe.
1934. Yeah.
Currency.
Page 41 may help us answer this. So just continuing on that line of questioning and such, there are two ways that generally currencies are kind of viewed as what's the right value of a currency, kind of hard to say. So it's all relative to other currencies. And two ways of comparing those two things are, one, interest rates, which is kind of what the second paragraph talks a little bit about. So that relative trade I was talking about in terms of where interest rates are higher versus where they're lower, and where you, more importantly, expect them to go higher or where you expect them to go lower, and you can do currency trades like that. The other way is the last paragraph talking about purchasing power parity. And so the chart in the lower right-hand corner says, okay, tell us about the price of a Big Mac. And The Economist, the magazine, The Economist, created the Big Mac Index, I think in 86 or something like that. And they basically said, you can buy a Big Mac anywhere around the world. How much does it cost? And is it on par? So if you buy a Big Mac in the UK today, it costs you something like $4.20. And if you buy it somewhere here in the US, it costs you about $5.50. Yeah. Well, it's still a Big Mac. So if that's the case, then the Big Mac Index tells me that the British pound is undervalued by 20%. And so they do that around the world. In fact, you can Google it. You'll pull up their website. You don't need a subscription or anything. You can just see all those numbers and how they trade and how they trended. And so that's the other way of saying, you know, where should currencies be? Keep in mind, that doesn't mean they equilibrate. It's not like saying, oh, so the British pound is cheap, and therefore it's probably cheap for a reason. So there's probably something else going on there. But it's an interesting way. So between purchasing power, parity, let's use the Big Mac Index today, but there are other ways of measuring that. And interest rate differentials, those are two ways of sizing up the currency differentials. And that's what's going on here today. It's mainly on the interest rate differentials.
You see a lot of holes in Big Mac. You've got labor, rent, supply chain issues. It seems, I don't even know why you do that. It doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, so that's true probably of any good or service you select.
Right.
You know, and you could probably look at McDonald's as saying probably better than most at taking the human element out of it. Every time I go in there, I think that I'm walking into a vending machine. It's kind of just so automated that it pops out in front of me. It's like, you know,
that's why some of us don't walk in there, just so you know.
Okay.
Walking in there tells us something about you.
So you're saying no one do drive through? I respect that.
Yeah. You drive through. The only thing I've ever in Hawaii, the hot apple pies in Hawaii are deep fried, and that's the only thing I've bought at McDonald's in the last 10 years. Deep fried hot apple pies in Hawaii. So, but anyway, I'm just teasing.
Alexa, cancel Candace's order.
And Ed, they don't control for like demand or eating habit changes amongst different countries.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
That's pretty difficult to do.
Exactly. And so let's not put too much stock in the Big Mac Index.
Yeah.
But it's more interesting to see how it changes and where the relative values are than, you know, whether it should be trading strictly at parity or not.
Yeah.
So. Let's just wrap up with take a quick look at the index returns on 47.
Mm-hmm.
So taking a look at the second quarter. And the equity markets in the U.S. in the upper left-hand corner showing nice returns, particularly in small caps. Small caps are captured by Russell 2000 index for the quarter, showing 7.8%. So again, think about small caps. What is more domestically focused? What has a less financials, more tech bend to it. Those all played well. Those themes played out well there. International, no surprise then, because as we talked about the currency effect and other issues with the trade and such, we're seeing negative returns there. Emerging market, -8, and the bottom, Latin America, at 17.8. And we just watch that number every quarter go back and forth. Sometimes it is the darling, and we wish we had more there, and then quarters like this, we're glad we don't have so much there. Fixed income in the upper right-hand side for the quarter, largely what we would expect, flat and positive, which is good because the prior quarter was slightly negative. And so you see that start to manifest itself in the year-to-date numbers. And then lower right-hand corner, various other indices for commodities, emerging market debt, hedge funds, and currencies. So unless there are any questions, we can move on to take a look at the performance of the plan in tab two. Okay, great. So turning to page two, we have starting the quarter at $8.445 billion. Net cash outflows partially offset by net investment change, so ending down slightly for the quarter, almost exactly $8.4 billion there. Taking a look at pages three and four, making sure we're within policy index and consistent with our asset allocation. So we have on page four, allocation versus long-term targets and allocation versus current. Current, roughly in line, we're slightly overweight with growth and underweight with liquidity, but I believe the memo to discuss the funding policy and the annual employer contributions will help get those spot in line. Continuing to build out the diversifying portfolio and cash overlay. Page five is not a new page, but a significantly reformatted executive summary page. So I'd certainly appreciate your feedback on this, you know, either now or later as ideas come to you. But we wanted to create a page that if you turn to it, you have the good view of how did our plan do? How did our investment program work? So in the upper left-hand corner, taking a look at the performance numbers, quarter, year-to-date, and the various time periods. So helping to understand across all those time periods, how did we do? Are we fulfilling our mission and objective? And then each component, growth, diversifying, and liquidity, are we getting out of that what we expected to? We'll talk more about those in a minute, about what the drivers are. And for the quarter, you can see that growth outperformed its index, diversifying underperformed, and liquidity basically right on top. And then the two charts at the right-hand side are things that I've always been beating the drum on in terms of risk and return. So let's keep in mind the standard deviation component to this whole discussion and how do we line up there. And in both the 3 and 5 year bases, we line up pretty well. So you can see that triangle is where the median is for the universe. So how do our peers look? And then we see that the total fund and the policy index numbers are right on top of each other for the 5 year, and the total fund is slightly below the policy for the 3 year. So on a risk return basis, we're doing quite well. It's an efficient portfolio, basically. So we see this in detail later where we take a look at Sharpe ratios. But for here, one quick look at the plan. Hopefully you get a picture of how's the total plan doing, how is each sub-portfolio doing, and how are we doing on a risk return basis. We also have the text on the left-hand side about the correlation. We think this is important because we've talked a lot about how the diversifying portfolio is expected to go up and down. The diversifying portfolio is expected to be our anchor, and so therefore they should have a low correlation between them. And so we show what the correlation has been over the 1, 3, and 5 year periods. As we move on to 6 and 7, just taking a look at the managers and highlighting a couple of them on page 6. Near the bottom, we have Rubico Boston Partners underperforming, and you can see it ranking in the 91st percentile. So it had a pretty good one-year number, a good 2017 for sure. We're seeing some of that pullback in the year-to-date and quarter number, and nothing there gives us any concern in terms of no change in people or process. It was some specific holdings with Cummins and Delta and Southwest, Johnson & Johnson, Gilead, and Novartis. So select companies, it's still a well-diversified fund. It has, I believe, over 80 stocks in it. It was just hit mostly by those six. And if we turn to page 7, here's where we see the impact of emerging markets. Our emerging markets composite down 10.1% against the index that was down 8, and so that puts us in 90th percentile. And each of our two managers underperforming, PIMCO, with research affiliates, the RAE model, underperforming 9.8 versus 8. So it had some specific exposure to technology, consumer discretionary, financials, and utilities. There is also a personnel change here. We don't view this as particularly important to this strategy because it's with regard to Rob Arnott, the chairman and CEO of the company, turning over the CEO title to Katrina Sherrard, who has been the president and COO for the past 6 years. So Mr. Arnott is, I believe, 64, so natural to see him change, turn over that title, but maintain his chair position with the board.
Sounds pretty young to me at this point. Just so we're clear on that.
64 is the new 30? Is that
right? Yes.
Second that motion.
He was the TT Emerging Markets. I don't know that one.
So TT, when did we hire them? A year and a half ago?
I think we funded them just about a year ago.
Okay. Yeah. Call that one.
Is that a German? TT was the other compliment to Simco. London-based firm. This tends to be a more concentrated, growth-oriented portfolio. It has more volatility. And this behavior is, unfortunately, what we expect with that ride. We expect a long-term result, but with more noise around quarter-to-quarter variability.
They have a really impressive track record. They've actually closed their strategy because they've been able to raise so much money, and their track record has been so strong. And they are very boutique-ish. They are boots on the ground, kind of go talk to the companies approach to their research. So unfortunately, this particular quarter, Argentina hit them pretty hard. Also did China. So that the Argentinian exposure caused them to underperform by about 2%, and the Chinese exposure caused them to underperform by about 1.8%, and a large part of that was the currency effect.
But that's not just for the quarter, because their year-to-date is equally negative.
Yeah.
Is that the same explanation then?
Largely, yeah. Yeah. And I could look up my notes from last quarter, see if there was anything else on that.
It doesn't ring a bell. Maybe I missed the meeting with them or something. I don't know. Okay. Is there another name they go by?
No.
It's not an abbreviation or something like that?
No, TT is just the one. And that's really all my comments on the individual strategies. You're seeing some underperformance from private credit. And some outperformance on private equity. So those are two key components, but you now have StepStone providing the direct oversight of the private markets components, so I think you'll be hearing more about that. Page 9, I did want to highlight that you're seeing the DFA, Insight, and SIT posting less than exciting returns. I mean, we weren't expecting a lot of excitement here. This is part of our liquidity portfolio, but now that we have them in place for 1 year, we had talked a lot about those being kind of 2% returns. And so this is the total returns for the strategies, which includes both the yield and the price component. So as rates have risen, their strategies and the holdings in their strategies has come off. So the priced value of their holdings has come down, whereas the actual yield that they generate has continued to be north of 2%. And so as comfort, you don't necessarily need to follow me here, but pages 77, 78, 79 show those characteristics to you. There's the yield to maturity for each strategy. So quickly, DFA has a 3.25 yield to maturity, Insight at 2.87, and SIT at 3%. So when you look at these and say, weren't we expecting more there? Yeah, we were. You're seeing the price effect here. The actual strategies being largely buy and hold means that they're going to hold them and ride that out and collect that 2% until the bond reaches maturity, and then they're out of it. So there's nothing concerning to me about those performance numbers. Pages 13 and 14 and 15 show the funding progress of the various private market commitments, with 16 and 17 showing the IRRs for them. And then pages.
Could I ask a couple of questions on page 15? They're kind of nits, but if you look at Aether, it says percent called 000.
Yeah,
obviously, that's not correct.
No, it's not. The way to calculate that is the 19 million for the first fund out of the 25 million.
Right.
So I agree with you. We'll find out what's going on there.
That's and the same thing for Oak Tree.
Yep.
And Paladin, it's maybe a rounding error, but the call exceeds the commitment. Is that a relatively common issue?
That can happen. So what they do is they call the capital, $25 million, and they'll reinvest distributions. So they might distribute and reinvest, and that might be, I don't know what the specific
during
terms
are. During the investment period, they're allowed to do that.
Okay. Just so long as you know that.
And I suspect that those zeros will also impact the bottom line 79%. That will likely go up.
It was kind of a standard question. What's going on the Gaulis? Anything new?
Yeah, the new is that we still have a remaining commitment, which is hard to believe.
We're just going through final liquidations there. It's zeroed out, essentially.
Okay.
So when it says we've got a commitment, we really don't have
it. It will never be called.
Right. Yeah. But that 34,000 whatever is, what is that representing?
Oh, that's Oak Tree.
The market.
Is that Oak Tree that you're
looking at? No, Nogales.
No, Nogales. That's 34,188. But what is that representing?
Oh. Residual claims on the last piece of, I'm trying to remember what the last investment was, but he sold it late last year. It's essentially some residual tax claims. He zeroed out at the end of this year.
But when we get that, I'm just curious, that 34,000.
It labels it as value, estimated market value.
Yes.
So that's the remaining value of the portfolio holding. That could be what you would expect to get when they finally distribute.
So we may or will get it?
Not likely. No.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. It's more curiosity. Obviously, it's not very much.
No, I think that's what Tim's saying. When it finally closes out, that's the current value of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the economics on that, Ed, are 14, just in pure dollars, forget present value for a moment, 14,805 was called, so we paid that to them. They paid us back $12,326,000, and we can expect an additional 34.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
That would be the profile of not a successful investment.
Yeah, I think that's been around.
But it does include two coupons for Big Mac.
Yeah.
In Europe.
That decision was
in Europe.
Got
that's right. You have to redeem them in Europe.
I just want to make clear that decision before I got on the board.
That's right. Four cents before almost anyone in this group.
2004.
Yeah. We'll try to get those Big Mac coupons changed to Apple Pies as well.
In Hawaii.
You missed that. It was
New Index.
In Hawaii. Apple Pies.
And you can follow the Nogales returns on 17, so that IRR calculation there is showing a negative as a result of that.
Got it.
And then 20 and 21, just the outline of the fee schedule, showing what we're paying across all of the publicly traded strategies there.
Conference I've ever attended always says fees are going down, they're negotiating fees, you hear that. Has anything ever happened in the last couple of years with fees, or is it just all talk?
No, the fees have been trending down. The issue has been where the fees been trending down, largely in hedge funds, which we don't participate in.
Right. Okay.
On the private equity side, that we've seen a modest trend down in base fees. A lot of the negotiations come down to, it's not the headline fee that changes, it's the terms. So we've had some more success moving from fees on committed capital to fees on invested capital. So the 1.5 number doesn't change, but what it's calculated on does. Okay. So the net impact to us has been trending down.
That's good.
Yeah. Those are all my prepared comments and a review of the plan, but happy to take any questions.
Anything else for Ed?
I got a quick general question. I think later today we're going to hear from Siegel that our funded status is climbing up into the upper 80s. Is there a point at which, I'm not sure who initiates, but maybe there's a conversation around kind of the risk profile of the investment program?
Yeah, great question. So lots of different ways it manifests itself. One is as a result of the liquidity program, we go through the annual review of the asset allocation. And I think that's a good time to talk about that because part of it is thinking about how much risk do we want to assume in the portfolio and what return do we expect to generate. And as your funded level starts to increase more and more, you can start thinking about reducing the assumed rate and therefore allowing us to reduce risk within the investment program. Commensurate with that is the ongoing view of the markets, and as we've seen prices appreciate, getting future returns is harder to do. So that also ties in with saying if we don't expect future returns to be as high, we either have to take on more investment risk or we should lower our assumption. So it's also a natural time then to do it. So we're looking at, you know, typically our review of that has been in kind of the March, April, May time frame, sometime around then, and I think that would continue. But it's always a topic we can bring up because I think it ties directly into the asset allocation of the program and whether anything should change. Are we aware of anything today that should change? So today's report, which I'll be interested to hear, is probably another step along that road.
Paul Angelo, if I remember correctly, said you had to be 125% funded to be 100% funded or fully funded.
Yeah, I think that comes from the idea that you would annuitize. So if you were to say, let's annuitize it, or even if we wanted to just think in that mindset, could we annuitize if we wanted to, even though we don't want to, what would it take? That then suggests you got to have a market level interest rate, and a market level interest rate is something that you'd probably say, tell me what my liabilities look like, tie them out to treasuries of similar duration, and that's going to give you a much lower number than a 6 or 7% kind of result. Therefore, you'd have to then increase the funding level significantly so you could absorb that, and by introducing a lower discount rate, that 125% becomes 100%, and there you go.
I took it as a minute of like there was another financial crisis. You have to have that buffer in there to sort of compensate for it.
Yes and no. I mean, the next downturn we have in the markets is going to be, I think all pension plans, not just Contra Costa, will be facing the challenge of saying, okay, what can we change about our actuarial assumptions to help it be a tolerable event for the sponsor and the check they have to write? What can we do about the investment program? Because in a market correction, we might see future returns now look better. Because as markets come down, we might say, oh, you know what? Getting 7% might be easier today. So you could change some assumptions that way, too, and change your investment program and decide where you want to take investment risk. And then there's the board discretion component in terms of, you know, what feels right. What are you hearing from all of your professionals, and where do you sit, and what responsibilities do you have? And so kind of taking that in account as well.
And Jay, we are also doing our experience study next year, so we will have a discussion around what the board, you know, what the board would like to do around that. And obviously, as our funding climbs, you know, the more we have in the market and the more potential volatility that we do have, so it's a good time to have that discussion.
Great. Look forward to that meeting.
There have been bits and pieces that have come out over time on various CalPERS funded entities, at least approaching CalPERS, on what it would take to buy out their obligation. Mm-hmm. And once they get that number, that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah,
period.
Of course.
The 125 won't come anywhere close to it, by the way. We're talking 200-300% of our current liability if we were to go to 3 to 3.5%,
right,
as contrasted to 7%.
Right.
Okay. Anything else for Ed?
Thank you.
Thank you. On to 7B. Tim Price.
Functional aspects of the plan, and this is a staff report that we presented for the first time last quarter. We got some feedback from trustees about how to improve it, to streamline it, and get the highlights to you quickly. So this is a revised version, and as with all revised versions, we look forward to revising it further based upon board feedback. But just a quick reminder, when we take a look at performance, and I think Ed gave an exhaustive review of the summaries and the manager lineup, when we take a look at this from a staff perspective, we kind of take a look at the three functional sub-portfolios and say, if those three are working as expected, the total fund is working as expected. And the metrics we focus on are unique for each program and I think reflect the conversations we've had in the boardroom about what we're trying to accomplish. So I'm just going to step through each of the three functional sub-portfolios, the liquidity, growth, diversifying. I'll highlight is most components are working as expected over the time frames that we focus on. There's a couple areas with room for improvement, and I'll touch on those as we move through this, and also give a little bit of a preview about what's changing in the program against this backdrop here. You all have a memo that has the same exhibits in this, but this is just for viewing ease here. So within the liquidity sub-portfolio, what we focus on is the quality, the duration, keeping that low, and the number of months of benefit payments in reserve. So this is the fewest moving pieces. This is the most straightforward portfolio we have. And on all three metrics, AA quality, 2-year duration, and 36 months of benefit payments, which is the low end that was refreshed in July back to 48, everything is meeting expectations there. So simplest program, and everything is in line with expectations. On growth, this is probably our largest, this is our most complex program here. But what we focus on here is, what are we getting in terms of absolute returns? Is it generating that long-term growth that we look at? And we focus on a rolling 5-year number. So in this case, we have a 5-year number of 9.6%. That is meeting expectations. We also take a look at relative to a simple benchmark. And when we say simple benchmark, say, is there a easy way of allocating the entire growth portfolio? In this case, we chose the MSCI ACWI benchmark simply because this is a global equity investment benchmark. If we did nothing else, if we pursued no further diversification into real estate and other asset classes, this is broadly representative of global growth. So we always want to say, is the diversification working for us? Is that active management working for us? Because there's always a simple implementation model. In this case, we've earned about 20 basis points over that broad public market index. And we note that's below expectations. It's nice to have the outperformance. We love to have the outperformance. All things equal, we would expect to be more highly compensated for the active management that we've put into that. So that is trailing our expectations a little bit there. Some of the explanation that goes into that is we have a long-term growth allocation that we're not quite at yet. We still have the private credit that's being built out. We are in the initial phases of that build-out with StepStone. They're actually going to be here in a month to talk about progress on the private credit build-out, so that's still yet to come. The other big piece that we need to fund yet is the risk parity, and that's also going to be coming up in September, the funding of that. So we have a couple moving pieces that we're still implementing on growth, and hopefully that'll help to nudge us forward to a better premium there. On the positive side, the efficiency of deployment. So a lot of times when we talk about growth, we're talking about, did we capture the growth available in the marketplace at a reasonable risk level? Well, we measured that by Sharpe ratio, and this basically says, what did we achieve above and beyond a risk-free rate per unit of volatility that we accepted here? Higher number is better. In this case, we've got a 1.6 Sharpe ratio, which is relatively high on historical standards here. Risk has been low. We've had the tailwind of good global growth, and particularly good U.S. equity growth. So that is right in line with expectations. That's actually a little bit higher than we would normally hope to achieve there. But we'll take it when we get the wins there.
Tim, going back to 20 basis points over on the benchmark relative returns, what number of basis points would cause you to go to meeting expectations as opposed to below?
The numbers that we knock around internally is a 50 to 100 basis point premium is where we, that's where our comfort level for taking on the additional risk and oversight of active management of private markets, that sort of thing. That's a number, and this is where it gets to a little bit more art than science, because certainly if we were taking on if we had exactly the benchmark return at half the risk, we would also call that a win. So that's why we take a look at multiple metrics here. But in terms of a return enhancement, 50 basis points is where we start to get comfortable that the return enhancement is working. In this case, we've accepted considerably less risk. So on that Sharpe ratio, we look at the interplay between those two and say, overall, we're comfortable. On that individual metric or that premium, we could stand some improvement there. And importantly, here with the growth, this is a long-term portfolio. We're taking a look at trailing 5-year numbers here. Lastly, on the risk diversifying portfolio, we're generally in good shape. We've seen the diversification. Ed showed you the correlation numbers in the Verisk quarterly report. We use a beta here, different ways of measuring offsets. But a beta of 0.1 or a correlation of, I think, 0.34 in the Verisk report shows that the risk diversifying portfolio is an offset to the growth portfolio. We also say this should not be costing us money. The risk diversifying portfolio should not be costing us money, and it should have a positive real return, so at least above inflation. Well, the reality is over the trailing five-year period, we've performed below inflation. So this is an area where we say the risk diversifying needs further enhancements. Now, this is as of June 30th. As of July 31st, we've funded a new component of this. So we've brought the parametric defensive equity strategy into the mix here. We expect that to be an enhancement. We also have a number of strategies under consideration that have shorter track records that might come into this, but this is an area that we continue to iterate on. So I would say the trailing 5 year is a little bit difficult here simply because most of this was not built over that trailing 5 year period. This is a aggregation of strategies that were in the portfolio, but not necessarily thought of as a risk hedge 5 years ago. They've migrated to that over time. So this is something we fully recognize. We want to get the returns up here, but other aspects of the program are working. So we roll those three together, say we've got some areas of improvement, but overall, we've got the 4 years of benefit payments in reserve, invested safely, so that's meeting expectations. We are participating in the growth opportunities available to us, and you know, largely I take a look at that Sharpe ratio. So a 1.6 versus a 0.9, we're capturing what's available to us at a reasonable risk level. The risk diversifying is diversifying. You know, the one thing we always want to be cautious of is you never want to diversify by having a negative return relative to a positive return. That is a way of getting diversification. It's a pretty rough way of getting diversification. Right now, we're kind of at, you know, we're even money on a nominal, and we're slightly below on a real basis on that, but we expect that to rise over time.
I think we'd call that solution by dilution if you do diversify.
That's another way of saying it, yes. I think that gives us a snapshot. I think in your memo, we've had additional appendices that show a heat map of the role of every manager line item that shows some highlights on individual manager developments, personnel changes. Ed touched on one of those earlier. I think the other ones have been mentioned at board meetings along the way, but ownership changes at Emerald, that sort of thing. And the one thing I did want to comment on in the appendices here, if you take a look in the memo on pages 9 and 10, the exhibit on the top of page 9 shows the spread of upside capture versus downside, and this is at the total fund level. So this just says when there's an up period for the simple target index, how much of that do we capture? When there's a down period for the simple target index, how much of that do we capture? And we've talked about with the trustees, we're not probably going, by virtue of our conservative stance, we're not going to capture all of the upside, but we certainly don't want to capture all of the downside. So the spread between those lines, we want to maintain that. We have maintained that. You'll see the gap narrowing there. I would say some of our spread historically is very difficult to capture on an ongoing basis. It might have been somewhat of a historical anomaly. But that positive spread of keeping the blue line above the orange line, that's what we want to focus on. So all in all, in line with expectations, we've got room for improvement on a couple of ongoing projects in the build-out of the growth and the risk diversifying. But everything else is in line with expectations there. I think the only things I wanted to highlight in the appendices were the role of Pierford in the growth portfolio. This is a value-oriented international equity portfolio. Value has been deeply out of favor. The value index has been deeply out of favor relative to growth opportunities. Ed touched on that in the U.S. We've seen that in the non-U.S. space as well. So Pierford, you'll see in the appendices over a five-year period, isn't adding the value that we would like versus ACWI. We also haven't had it for that full five-year period. That's based upon their longer-term composite. We haven't been in there quite that long. Allianz in the high-yield space has also been somewhat difficult. Allianz, you might recall when we talked about asset allocation in the last couple of years, we have not had a long-term strategic allocation to high yield. We're using this as a funding source for private credit. We've had extensive conversations with StepStone about where to warehouse money intended for the private credit, and the consensus is high yield is as good as anything else as a proxy to draw down against. So that'll be declining over time. And the only other thing would be private equity has had a difficult past year. You'll see the longer-term numbers there, the five-year numbers. We're adding just a bit under 4%. We do target a 4% premium to the public markets. We're not quite there. This is, you know, we're in the midst of that migration from a primarily fund-to-funds implementation approach to a primarily direct approach. That will take a long period of time to run through, but that reduction in fees is probably going to drive a narrowing of that spread. A narrowing of that deficit. So it'll drive the premium up a bit there.
Why would private equity not perform what
we had expected? Two factors there. I think the absolute returns on private equity have been good. I think the returns, and we measure this versus a premium over public equity. What you're talking about here is the denominator effect of the public equity has just been so strong over this period. It's been difficult for the private equity to capture it, to beat it. We have beaten it. It's simply not by as much as we would normally have liked to. I will say a 4% premium over public markets is probably something that we will need to review in the future, given the dynamics of the industry, the conversations we've had with various other parties. I think most other investors are looking at closer to a 2% premium over the public markets, which is still a healthy premium, but that'll be a future topic of conversation. What we have in the policy right now is 4% over public markets. I don't have the Verus report right in front of me, but I mean the five-year number for U.S. equity is 14-ish percent. No, I'm sorry. That was the shorter term. But I think there's like a 300 basis point. Let me not speculate in terms of the expert. U.S. equity has been strongly up. Private equity.
I'm just saying that the absolute return was performed as expected.
It was positive. It was positive, close to double digits over 5 years.
14%, you're way off. It's 13.6.
I'm sorry. And private equity over that five-year period?
I don't have index for that.
No, our experience.
11.9.
Yeah, so we're getting some of the deficit in there. Yeah.
So, Tim, given what you just mentioned about private equity, what time frame should the board continue to see this kind of behavior? When would we expect this to flip more green?
Yeah. I would say, in terms of the trend line on private equity in isolation, seeing the fee reduction by going direct, that will take years. That will take years. I mean, our private equity is still going to largely be allocated to the legacy pieces. The bulk of the dollars will be allocated to the legacy pieces for the next 5 years as we trend towards the direct model. The effect of the public market benchmark gale, that's the noisy one. That's the one that's difficult to anticipate there. But, you know, one of the ways of increasing returns is reducing fees. And I think that's largely the story of what we're trying to accomplish in private equity right now, is the opportunity set is compressed. The public markets have run up, and we're taking a look at this on a forward-looking basis. We're still expecting a premium by using private markets, by using private equity.
Right.
It's not as big as it used to be. So what can we do to enhance that? One of the things we can do to enhance that is minimize the fee load. And minimizing the fee load, 5 years. We'll see a trend line towards that, but to actually see it manifested in a meaningful way, it'll be about that time frame.
If public equities go down, how would that impact our private equity? What's likely the correlation on that?
There is a lag effect. I would prefer to run the numbers and get back to you. There's certainly a connection. I mean, we're talking economically sensitive assets. Not a direct correlation, but a relatively high correlation. We would consider them to be partial proxies for one another. It's still U.S. economic growth, but the way money is used in a private company and a public company can be very different. You don't have the share buybacks, that sort of thing. Tends to be more the money goes back to the end investor in the private markets. That's not a universal statement, but largely. Okay.
Tim, hasn't there been a flood of money into private equity investments, people trying to chase yield and so forth, and has that had a negative impact on our overall expectations of what we can expect from, or to realize going forward?
Yeah.
If there's been just chasing that that yield, less quality investments per se, or
Yeah, I mean, certainly we've all seen the stories, and they're very true, about the private equity commitment overhang, the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been committed and not yet deployed. And there are areas of private equity that no doubt have become overheated. A lot of that has pulled back this year, but in the past year, late-stage growth equity, so venture capital in companies about to go public. The valuations were incredibly rich there. We were seeing, some of the multiples paid were 10 times EBITDA, which is very high to go into, and it doesn't leave a lot of room left on there. Early stage, less so. Small buyouts, less so. So we've tried to target the areas of private equity where we thought the valuations were lower, were being less impacted by that flood of capital coming in. The other thing is the private equity universe has gotten significantly larger. The public markets are simply a lot smaller than they used to be. There's a broad-based U.S. equity benchmark called the Wilshire 5000. It had 5,000 stocks in it when it was created back in the late 80s, I believe. Ed, we're down to, do you know the number now? It's like 3,000. So the number of publicly listed companies is simply smaller, a lot smaller. They exist longer. I mean, in the Bay Area, we've all seen the effect of companies that largely would have IPO'd much earlier, staying private for longer. Uber is a poster child for this. The universe of private markets is simply dominating what's going on in the public markets. Private equity and venture capital kind of control who becomes public. Buyouts control who goes from public back to private. It's simply a very, very robust portion of the overall economic environment now. So is there additional money overhang? Yeah, absolutely. But what is being targeted towards is also a larger universe there.
Does that do merger and acquisitions as well? Get that lower number?
There's been some mergers. I think we've seen a lot of the, private equity buyouts, taking a public company, taking it private. And just simply not having as many new entrants coming into the public market via the IPO. I think both those have played a role. Plus the mergers, I think in the past we might have seen mergers being, we'd see the consolidation and then new entrants coming in to try to fill some of the gaps there. We're simply not seeing as many new entrants coming in as well. Any other questions on the functional roles here? All right.
You're getting a lot of inquiries from other public retirement systems about what we're doing.
We maintain a pretty healthy dialogue with a number of systems, and we pick their brains about their implementation approach, and they pick our brains about our implementation approach. I will say, this approach is not for every plan, and it requires a very strong funding policy to do something like this. But certainly we maintain that dialogue. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.